Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
This report was actually requested by Congress in the 2018 Farm Bill.
USDA economic researcher Scott Callahan.
That was our impetus for starting this research. Congress asked us to look at potential barriers to land access for socially disadvantaged and beginning farmers, in particular to look at the extent to which federal programs may help improve land access. What we're studying here, we're looking at the percentage of socially disadvantaged farming operations and the percentage of beginning farming operations at the county level. And we constructed a bunch of county level measures of federal program participation, of land access characteristics, of production characteristics, kind of throwing the kitchen sink in here to see what is correlated with the percentage of socially disadvantaged farming operations and the percentage of beginning farming operations.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Summer begins to change, so my methodology here is I'm not just putting all my La Nina eggs in one basket.
Matt Makins with Makins Weather speaking at the recent Cattle Facts Annual Outlook Seminar on weather.
For the summer, we have allowed enough time for the ocean to tell the atmosphere we're neutral now. The atmosphere begins to respond to that. So for your summer forecast, it's largely a neutral-based forecast. And Troy with Cattle Facts asks, what does that mean? La Nina provides extremes of one kind. El Nino provides extremes of another kind. To be neutral, you begin to eliminate the extremes. In the analogs, when I ran them, and the precip is shown now, they, in my opinion, they did not encapsulate enough of the monsoon. As you transition out of La Nina into El Nino, the monsoon is usually quite robust. So going into the summer with a better monsoon again, we've already started the soil replenishment for the Southwest this last year and now. With another good monsoon, we're spreading that soil moisture out. So the analogs didn't really do a good job, in my opinion, for the monsoon. But it did still capture the benefits of this transition for the Central Plains, the Northern Plains, the Southern Plains, finally into Texas too, of having a more favorable moisture outlook this summer versus the last several years. And that moisture becomes evened out pretty much everywhere east of the Rockies. A much more favorable precip pattern emerges this summer than over the years past. That dry signal you see right through the central part of the Corn Belt, when the monsoon is super accurate and super active, we take away moisture from the Corn Belt, part of Mother Nature's balancing act. For the Corn Belt to have a tremendous wet season, tremendous year, we don't want the monsoon to be that strong. So it's going to be give and take this summer as far as the monsoon and placing moisture in the central Corn Belt. Temperatures, still going to be reacting to spring. It's still going to be relatively neutral to cooler than average in pockets across the growing areas as we go throughout the summer. Part of that is reacting to the cooler spring. Part of that will be reacting to the soil moisture benefits and gains. But this is very neutral territory for temperatures in the summer. Yes, still hot in Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, in the Southwest. Side by side, there's your summer forecast. And I do believe the monsoon forecast was not accurately projected in my analog selection. But that remains to be seen. And again, that has impacts on the Corn Belt for moisture this spring.
What happens if we see a strong movement from La Nina to El Nino?
We're going to have so much water across the country if El Nino truly kicks in into high gear this fall. I think the transition is too quick. I think we do have wetness this fall in pockets, surplus in some cases. But I don't think we can fully transition. I think it's going to be drawn out. And for factors we can discuss in private at the Cattle Facts booth if you'd like, there are other factors tying into this transition that will slow the progression of El Nino kicking in. It will kick in, but give it some time. So your fall outlook, in my opinion, is across the top. If El Nino fools me and it's full bore by September, October, look at the difference on the bottom. Southern U.S. soaking wet and much colder than the projection on the top.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There's seven states that USDA estimates have over a million beef cows. Kansas is one of those.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer.
And on a percentage basis, Kansas had the largest pullback. And I find that interesting. Kansas is not the only one that's had a drought by any means. There's probably more to it than just a drought. But Kansas is one of the states that had multiple months and a sizable share of the state, not just a couple of counties. Our industry as a whole was adjusting. So that's worth noting. There's a lot of implications of that we could talk about. We're going to probably import even more feeder cattle, all that kind of stuff. But I bring it up not just because I'm wearing a purple shirt and we're sitting on purple campus here, but our agmanager.info website has a resource. So most of your listeners probably know or remember Dr. Kevin Duvetter, used to be in our department. He originally built an Excel tool. It's called KSU-Beef Replacements. It's an economic resource to use to value, and specifically the net present value of what you could pay for replacement into your herd. That's timely, not because I think everybody's going to expand the herd next week, but again, take the Kansas number. I anticipate the herd in Kansas will build back. I don't know that it'll go back to the old highs. Don't go that far, but I do think we'll add females back to the herd when Mother Nature allows it and as profitability resumes. Profitability is projected to occur over the next couple of years, so that part might occur to be determined if Mother Nature supports that. But I wrote down one specific number in this tool to kind of motivate and bait people to go use it. If you use USDA's project prices for the next 10 years, if you use the case of a $900 cost, cash cost to run a cow for the year, and you plug in 8% discount rate, and those are the defaults in the tool that I just updated while I'm sharing them. If you buy or retain your own heifer here in 2023 and expect to have the first calf to sell from her in 2024, if you expect to get six calves, which is a rough estimate, 5 to 8 is the number depending on who you talk to. If you think you get six calves of production, the net present value in that story is $1,332. The way you interpret that number is you could pay $1,332 for that female if you expect to get exactly those USD prices, your cost for that, and if you're quote-unquote okay with an 8% return. Conversely, if somebody's in the exact same situation, but they have more favorable cost structure, so if they can run that cow for $775, so $125 a year less than the base scenario to start through, the net present value in that case is $1,778. So a full $400 and almost $50 more, higher value for that animal. I'm highlighting it just to illustrate having lower cost is really important. And it illustrates who's going to, quote unquote, win the bidding wars as we start rebuilding the herd. Operations that have lower cost structure or accept a lower discount rate or are more optimistic about calf prices, or obviously any combination of those three, are the ones that are going to be positioned to pay more. And this tool quantifies that. But you can use this resource to say, what, quote unquote, should I be paying? If I'm targeting a certain rate of return and I know my cost, you can go in and you can add or subtract from the calf prices that are projected and so forth. So my main point here today is to remind people that decision tools on Ag Manager, it's been there for quite some time. I just updated it this past week, and it seems timely given the broader discussion about the herd size.
Now, Randy Block is president and CEO of CattleFax, says if you want to find sustainability, it begins with profitability.
So I think when we think about this, we think about the word sustainability. One of the things that I challenge all of you with when we think about that and where we are, again, that's something that really starts with profitability. That's one of the main pillars of that. And obviously being socially responsible, environmentally on target with what we're doing, being able to measure that and being able to tell the story. This situation, as we talk about climate change, we talk about carbon and methane, those are things that are not going to go away. And I would encourage each and every one of you in the room to be, collect your data. We don't know exactly where all that's going yet today, but it is coming. I don't think it's going to go away. So, again, be prepared, do your homework, and continue to move forward in those areas.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Interest rates for all of us in the room have had a huge impact on our bottom line.
Speaking at the Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar, Mike Murphy talking about inflation.
We got another quarter point increase yesterday. We would expect to see another quarter to maybe two more of those quarter point increases sometime here going into the spring. From our standpoint, though, as we get in here towards with prime rates at 8.25%, we don't really see any relief for the remainder of the year. So it's not so much about how much more of an increase we're going to have here in the short term. Those should be fairly minimal. But don't expect to see any relief from our vision through the remainder of the year. There's a lot of economists that are talking that way, talking about how the Fed's going to cut rates. I feel like, and I think from a staff perspective, we've got to take Chairman Powell for his word. and that he is going to stick to his guns and he's going to sustain these rates at these higher levels.
And obviously, inflation makes everything more expensive. What about energy cost?
One of the big wild cards that we look in here towards 2023 is energy cost. And we've been in an environment in here over the course of the last year, as you look at the total world production and consumption, where things have been fairly balanced between the two. We had a little bit of that outstripping of consumption for a minute, got prices really high, like, say, last summer. We got that kind of realigned. But energy is really a wild card. For those that have the handout that we provided, we're really sitting in there looking at energy values, if we're looking at crude oil, to be sitting in here at the mid-70s is kind of the low end of the range for the remainder of the year. But we've got to keep in mind when we start to look at some of those other types of things like stocks. And I want you all to look at the natural gas line there, that purple line. We've transitioned here where now natural gas stocks compared to the 5-year average are now above that 5-year level. We've all witnessed what that has meant to the value of natural gas. You know, you've seen it going from a spot market at $9 down to sub $3. An incredible correction in that marketplace. And the reason being is fundamentally we've been able to build that stocks back up to an environment that is, I wouldn't say healthy, but more balanced for sure. Now, alternative, look at what we're seeing here on distillate, which we always, most of us in this room, is going to kind of translate that back to diesel. And again, for however many months, we've been sitting here with really small stocks levels. Consumption's high relative to diesel. Refinery challenges are certainly in place in many instances. And so we've drawn down that stocks level. And we know what that has meant for those that drive diesel pickups, right? And for the farming ranching community, we see this really wide spread between retail diesel and retail gasoline prices, and that has had a huge impact on us as producers from a cost of production standpoint. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of resolution to this as we look at 2023. So we got to keep that in mind as we're doing our budgeting and looking forward here, that we're going to maintain this elevated price from a diesel standpoint. And it really just goes back to the fact that we just haven't got to a spot to be able to build those stocks back up. Demand is outstripping that supply is the bottom line.
Mike Murphy with Cattle Facts. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index was up 4 points this month compared to December, and that's up 28 points over the last 2 months. That also leaves the index up 9% compared to a year earlier.
Dr. Jim Mentert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue University. He's looking at the first Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer, the reading from January.
The index of current conditions and the index of future expectations were both up this month. The index of current conditions was up just 1 point compared to last month, and that leaves it 2% higher than a year ago. The future expectation index was up 5 points compared to December, and that leaves it 13% higher than it was a year earlier. The Farm Financial Performance Index declined to a reading of 93. That's down 16 points this month as producers shifted their comparison to 2023 versus 2022, and they expect weaker financial performance in 2023 compared to last year. 22% of the farms in this month's survey say they expect to have a larger farm operating loan in 2023 than they did in 2022. And 80% of those who expect a higher operating loan say it's because of higher input cost. And just 5% of them say it's because of unpaid operating debt being carried over from the prior year, which is down substantially compared to prior surveys. The Farm Capital Investment Index was up 2 points compared to last month, and that leaves it 11 points higher than it was in November. However, it's still 7% lower than it was in January of 2022. Once again, we asked producers who said it's a bad time to make large investments in their farming operation why they'd feel that way. And the number one reason continues to be the increase in prices for farm machinery and new construction. However, note that more producers are citing rising interest rates as a reason the last 2 months. The short-term farmland value index was down 4 points this month compared to a month earlier, and that leaves that index down 15% compared to a year ago. The long-term index, however, was up 2 points compared to last month, and it's only down 2% compared to 1 year ago. Once again, we asked producers who expect to see farmland values rise over the next 5 years what their primary reason for the expectation of the increase in values is. In this month's survey, 63% said it was non-farm investor demand. That's up substantially compared to last fall. For example, last October, just 47% of the producers in the survey said it was because of non-farm investor demand. We continue to ask producers about their interest in carbon contracting on their farm operations. In the January and in the August 22 survey, about 9% of the producers reported having discussions with companies about carbon contracting on their farms. That compares to 7% who said they had had discussions back in the first quarter of 2021. However, across all of our surveys, just 1% of producers report having signed a carbon contract.
We get numbers from the barometer. They're lagging numbers, what's already happened. But what about looking into the future? World Ag Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekimowski.
This year, the theme of the forum is U.S. agriculture, seeds of growth through innovation. So as is often the case with this forum, it's a forward-looking event that we try to focus on the state of the art of agricultural technology and looking ahead for opportunities for developing a more prosperous and a more productive agriculture sector. So this year's program kind of continues in that general theme with regard to the opening sessions, the plenary sessions of the program. They tend to be organized by the Office of the Secretary. We are moving back to in-person this year. Really looking forward to getting a good participation, a good crowd in the room to provide us that energy that you can only get from attending these kind of meetings in person. So we're going to be back at the Crystal City Gateway Marriott. There will also be the opportunity for people to participate virtually if they are just simply unable to make it in person.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Better news than we've had for a couple months here. So both retail, so think grocery store for at home, as well as food service, away from home demand, we saw improvement compared to December.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
Specifically, 6 of the 8 categories I track had stronger demand than in the month of December. For grocery store demand, it was only shrimp and plant-based patties that were down. So both beef and both pork and the chicken breasts that we track were up compared to December. When we look over to food service, plant-based patty again was down compared to December, but so was pork chop demand. So the 2 beef and the baby back ribs is the other pork one that we track, and chicken breast meal again were all up. There's a little bit of an uptick in optimism among consumers. I'm not going to tell you we're out of the woods by any means, but I think there's less pessimistic signals is probably the more accurate way to say that as we went through the month of January. Inflation expectations are easing is a component of that. You and I are sitting here staring at an ugly figure I've built, in audio world. People can't see this, but if you follow me on Twitter or whatever, you can see some of these figures or pull up the actual report that's on Ag Manager. But we're looking at a bar chart here that is summarizing expectations of what consumers think meat prices, specifically grocery store beef and pork prices next month will be. And residents in the U.S. continue to expect higher retail meat prices. But the magnitude of increase is actually the lowest this past month we've had since all the way back to May of 21. And I just threw a lot of info at the listeners, so I'll back up and kind of repeat it, is the public's still expecting higher meat prices next month. But the magnitude of increase is the smallest we've had since May of 2021. And to me, that aligns with moderating inflation through the whole economy. Inflation is still historically high, but it's not 8-9% like we've had at one point. And I think consumers are passing that on in the form of their expectations for higher meat prices. That would be good. Now, in many ways, there's a lot of discussion around this, but lower meat prices itself isn't necessarily good if it's because demand has slipped. Right. So we got to think through this. If it's an affordability issue, that's different. If it's a product quality issue, that's different. The reason a price comes down is really important. But what this just tells us is consumers are getting more optimistic that the asking price of the grocery shelf will be going up slower than it has been in the past.
Now, that's the meat demand monitor. But he says a lot of concern right now over egg prices.
We have to remember eggs is an ingredient in so many things. People think about what they do with the carton of dozen eggs you take at home, and I fully am cognizant of the higher price that's there, but they are an ingredient in so many things that it has an impact on food price in different places that people think through. But at the same time, eggs are still a pretty cheap thing compared to a lot of other things in our basket. So percentage change-wise, yeah, it's a lot higher, and I'm not trying to dismiss the issue, but I do encourage people to have some context on, for the average person in the U.S., food is still affordable, and as a percentage of our expenditures, food is lower than most, and eggs is a small portion of that as well. So some context is important.
Back over to the meat demand monitor, he said, they're asking a new question.
We ask now in the MDM how many eating occasions, so meals and snacks, did you have yesterday? And then we tally that up by generation. And three eating occasions is still the most common number. So breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be the traditional thing you'd answer there. But there's more people, regardless of their age, that eat four or more times a day than there are that eat less than three. So if you don't eat the traditional three, you're more likely to have an additional snack, is the way to interpret that, as opposed to skipping a meal. That pattern is strongest for younger generations, which is why I was alluding to you there on the difference. So, you know, millennials and Gen Z, so those have been born since 1981, are much more likely to say they have four or five or even six, the way we track this, eating occasions, than somebody's like Gen X or baby boomer, so they were 1980 or older birth date. The implications of that from the meat industry are, particularly among younger generations, I think portion size, product convenience are elevated in importance. And looking forward, not just sitting here in February of 23, but think the next decade, couple decades, as those younger generations gain buying power and disproportionately become the main consumer in the U.S., and the millennials already are, but even more so in decades ahead.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So this lesser prairie chicken listing came out in November of 2022, right before the end of the year, and it affects five states. The northern DPS includes Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and portions of Colorado, and the southern DPS includes portions of Texas and New Mexico.
Talking lesser prairie chickens, Sigrid Johannes with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
And so what we're looking at here is a situation where the voluntary conservation efforts that have been going on for decades now, and, you know, at the great expense to cattle producers, but they've made that voluntary investment to protect habitat and to support the species, it's basically being disregarded now by Fish and Wildlife. They're saying that's not good enough. We're going to impose this listing anyway. And I think it's a little bit of a slap in the face, frankly, to people who have really been the single pillar upholding the survival and the existence of the species. You know, you don't find lesser prairie chicken in cropland. You don't tend to find them, you know, around human development in some of this, you know, more sprawling areas that we're starting to see across that region. But you do find them in rangeland. You do find them in diverse pastures, which are exactly the kind of landscapes being cultivated by our producers. So, you know, at the most fundamental level, we think this listing is inappropriate for the conservation goals that everyone has for this species. But then on another note, and one that's very alarming to NCBA and PLC alike, is this 4D rule that's been written into the listing for the northern DPS. This is a system where, according to Fish and Wildlife, you will only satisfy the requirements for that 4D rule, that legal protection against incidental take, if you are following a grazing management plan that's been approved by a third party. We don't even know who those third parties are right now, but we have a lot of concerns about the road that takes us down.
One of the problems is it appears as though the government doesn't know what the government is doing.
You would think that the right hand of the government sort of knows what the left is doing, and NRCS regularly reviews grazing plans, you know, all the time for, you know, through initiatives like Working Lands for Wildlife, for example. You also have entities out, you know, further in Colorado and New Mexico, like the BLM or the Forest Service, who are also regularly reviewing those grazing plans. What is especially troubling about this situation is we've, you know, asked point blank, is NRCS going to be on that approved list of reviewers? And as of now, the answer from Fish and Wildlife is no. They are not going to be on that list, and there's been a lot of inconsistent reports across northern Texas and parts of the panhandle on a county-by-county basis. Offices are getting different guidance, and some of them are, you know, looking at plans and signing off. Others are not. It's just a very uncertain situation, and you can see the mess that this creates on the ground when you have federal, you know, bureaucrats in D.C. who are making a rule for people, many, many hundreds of miles away and completely removed from the landscape and what it actually takes to conserve this habitat and support the bird.
Despite the challenges, they have seen wins.
As much as we advocate for good ideas, a large part of our job in D.C. is killing the bad ideas. And I think a major victory for the Public Lands Council this year and for NCBA and our other national partners is the thousands of acres, millions of acres and thousands of miles of rivers that have not received a federal land designation in the past year. When you look at bills like the River Democracy Act, when you look at some of the different land designations for new, expanded national monuments, new wilderness areas, new recreation areas. Those are efforts that come up every Congress, and they're always, you know, persistent, but we have to smack them down every year over and over again. And, you know, that work is not particularly headline-making, but it is critically important, because if you total those up, particularly, in an administration that is sort of laser-focused on this idea of conservation and taking acres out of production, it adds up to a whole lot of land, and it adds up to a whole lot of people's livelihoods. So we're very proud of the fact that many of those bills did not make it across the finish finish line. And in the coming Congress, we're going to be ready to combat those again.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
A return to in-person conferencing at this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum, February 23rd and 24th, includes guest speakers live at the two-day event in Arlington, Virginia. World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jakodowski says that includes, for the Thursday evening dinner,
Dr. Karen St. Germain from NASA, Director of the Earth Science Division, who is going to give some of her perspective on ways that data from NASA and satellite Earth observation can help to improve better understanding our global food supply and crop production patterns.
Also, European Union Ag Commissioner Janusz Wojciechowski joins Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack for a Friday morning conversation during the forum. Further details about and registration for this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum is available online at www.usda.gov/oce/ag-outlook-forum. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.